better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world is to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak. I want to welcome you to another evening of Progressive News Network. Tonight we have a very interesting set of guests, all focused on the safety of your food. We've got Michael Hansen, senior scientist from Consumer Union Consumer Reports. We've got Gene Economos, who is a pesticide awareness training person who works with Farm Workers Association. We've got Ms. Winona Howder of Food and Water Watch. She's going to talk about the safety and the information in her book, Foodopoly. We've got Jeffrey Rooks from the Environmental Whistleblowers Association, PEER. And we've also got Zach Caldevier, who is in Consumer Organics. So they're all going to be talking to you about different issues regarding food safety and water safety. This is a show you should not miss. Make sure you tell your friends. And, of course, as always, we've got some news, so let me do the news first. By the way, further details and links can be found at avaryvoice.com. So here we go. More news from Fukushima. The Fukushima trench water crisis returns. This is from Tokyo Electric Power. They said Saturday that the trench problem at the crippled Fukushima number 1 nuclear plant has cropped up again and is sending highly radioactive water into the sea. The water contains 2.35 billion becquerels of cesium per liter. The trench is believed to be the source of groundwater problem that's been baffling TEPCO experts for months. Their current theory is that the highly radioactive water found and left in the trench in 2011 is now leaking directly into the groundwater. Utility hopes to halt the problem by building a wall out of liquid glass. Once again, let me read that. Building a wall out of liquid glass between the reactor and the sea and removing the contaminated water from the underground passage. Also, more information. Extremely contaminated water is seeping to the ocean from reactor 2 from the turbine building. TEPCO says we believe it's staying in the trench. And I think they've been offering the Brooklyn Bridge for sale there as well. The highly radioactive, they believe, is staying in the pit, adding that the utility will nevertheless check carefully for possible leaks in the surrounding soil and seal the ground to block such leaks from reaching the sea. They're going to eventually get to that, I'm sure. They're sure they're going to stop it leaking to the ocean eventually. Yeah, we'll be holding our breath there, TEPCO. Luckily, though, the Pacific Ocean only is found in Japan and will impact no one else anywhere. So that's the good part. Consumers Union has a statement on the new long-term study of feeding genetically engineered grain to pigs. This is a statement from the gentleman who will be the guest today. Michael Hansen, senior scientist, Consumers Union, on the long-term study of feeding GE grain to pigs. Of course, it's different when you feed it to humans. The new peer-reviewed long-term pig feeding study just published raises important concerns about health impact of consuming genetically engineered GE corn and soy. There have been very few animal feeding studies of GE food to date, and extremely few that lasted longer than 90 days. This new study looked at pigs fed GE corn and soy under commercial production conditions over a 22.7-week period compared to the control group that was fed conventional corn and soy. The GE-fed pigs showed significant increases in severe stomach inflammation and thickening of the uterus. The study online is available. Again, you can find that if you go to avaryvoice.com. Consumers Union, the advocacy arm of Consumer Reports, has long been concerned about the impact of GE crops and thinks the effects are a red flag and deserves further study. We also believe the study underlines the need for labeling of GE food since there's still so much to learn about their long-term health effects. Consumers Union urges state legislatures, as well as Congress and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, to require GE foods the way so much of the rest of the civilized world actually does. A new long-term study, which looked at pigs over the normal commercial lifetime of 5 months, reinforces concerns prompted by the highly controversial Cerellini study, which looked at rats fed GE food over a two-year period compared to rats fed a non-GE diet. That study also found differences in health outcome, including higher rates of tumors, liver and kidney problems, among rats fed a GE diet. A new study of pigs, published in the Journal of Organic Systems, is valuable because it uses a relatively large study sample, 168 pigs, including controls, and was conducted at a U.S. pig production facility in Iowa. The research was done by an Australian scientist. The study found the uteri of GE-fed pigs was significantly larger, weighed 25% more, than those of non-GE-fed pigs. In addition, the rate of severe stomach inflammation was more than 2.5-fold higher on average for GE-fed pigs compared to non-GE-fed pigs, 32% versus 12% respectively. Indeed, for male pigs, the rate of severe stomach inflammation was four times higher for GE-fed males than non-GE-fed males, and for females, the rate was more than twofold higher. The authors conclude the result indicates it would be prudent for GM crops that are destined for human food and animal feed, include stacked GM crops, to undergo long-term animal feeding studies, preferably before commercial planting, particularly for toxicological and reproductive effects. Hey, Monsanto has received approval for a refuge in a bag. I'm just going to leave that story. That just is too crazy. Vast pigweed conspiracy. Editor's note, extension weed scientists are warning that farmers across the Midwest face increasing risks that weeds such as water hemp, mare's tail, or giant ragweed are developing resistance to glyphosate herbicides. The point to farmers' experiences in the South as an example of what can happen when growers lose a tool like Roundup Ready corn or soybeans. Dr. Hansen will give us the details on how this genetic engineering in these plants is actually done, and I'm sure you'll want to keep notes on that. It's a very interesting process and thrilling, almost as thrilling as an explosion in a summer blockbuster. This article in our sister publication, Delta Farm Press, veteran weed scientist, you remember veteran weed scientist Ford Baldwin, addresses the issue that faces cotton, corn, rice, and soybean producers in Arkansas and other mid-south states. Palmer amaranth is a close cousin to water hemp. In a recent article written about the Pigposium held last November in Arkansas, he had never seen anything like it. 800 or so folks attending a meeting on one weed. Everyone left the meeting charged up and full of vim, vam, and vigor to whoop this weed. And by the way, speaking of vim, vam, and vigor, I do want to dedicate this week's show to Argle Bargle, and you know who you are. The words came right from Judge Scalia's lips, and again, tonight's show is dedicated to Argle Bargle. Now back to the news. These guys are working extremely hard, but as an industry, we're not giving them much support. They are delivering the message and no one's listening. I have found out that I do not have any influence either. Folks, unless we're going to have some dramatic changes, pigweed is going to take over Arkansas. My God, I thought it already had. If this year does not get your attention, I give up. He does not have all the answers to the pigweed problem. We certainly don't have hard answers like in the early 90s. Roundup Ready came along and it was the answer. By the way, in case you hadn't heard this, Roundup Ready GE crops essentially make it possible for them to use lots and lots and lots of Roundup pesticide. So the genetic engineering isn't to decrease the necessity of using more pesticide. It's to make the plant resistant so they can dump even more pesticide. And again, Dr. Hansen will go into that in quite a bit of detail. But it's a point that's not often made, that these GE crops that are Roundup ready are basically being prepared to accept more and more pesticide, not less and less, as one might hope. Okay, next story up. EPA has recently granted registration approval for Syngenta's AgriSure Vituperia 3220 corn trait stack, This stack includes the Viptera trait for above-ground pest protection and also contains the AgriSure CBLL trait for the European corn borer, the AgriSure GE trait for glycophosphate tolerance, there we go, glycophosphate, and the Herculeum 1 trait for second modes of both broad-spectrum lepidopteran protection and corn borer protection. My God, I'll tell you what. Interesting stuff you see here. And by the way, like I say, the full stories are available at AveryVoice.com. Fire shuts down the Callaway nuclear plant, but that's okay. No imminent danger. Remember that phrase, no imminent danger. It's a phrase you'll hear often on this show. No imminent danger. At 11:49 Friday, our Emmeran, Missouri Callaway Energy Center declared an unusual event due to a small fire in a turbine building. A press release from Emmeran, Missouri Electric Company stated, "Our first priority was to stabilize the nuclear plant. Everything operated per design." Senior Director of Nuclear Operations for the Callaway Energy Center said there was no release of radioactivity in the environment above the normal operating limits. The press release stated, "And all appropriate federal, state, and local agencies have been informed." Chaos over 4 underground oil blowouts in Canada. But first, let me give you this little bit of perspective from our guest tonight, Dr. Michael Hansen. And we call this How to GE Food. There we go, Dr. Hansen. For people who are unfamiliar with the technology involved in genetic engineering, could you kind of walk through the process of the installation of nuclear material in a nucleus?
You take the gene that codes for resistance to glyphosate. That's a gene that actually comes from a soil bacteria. They then, to move it into a plant, they have to slightly modify that gene. They have to add an on switch. It's called a promoter. That comes from a plant virus. And then they have to have an off switch, which also comes from a different bacteria. And the way they insert this genetic material is they make one of these cassettes, and then there's the biolistics method, and what that does is you take little tiny pieces of gold or tungsten, and you coat it with the genetic material you want to transfer, and then you literally shoot that material into a petri dish that has cells from the plants you want to transform. And the idea is that you're literally shooting these, with this biolistics method, you're shooting these little tiny particles of tungsten or gold that are coated with DNA. Those are being shot into these cells. So that's actually a real nice metaphor, because the process of genetic engineering, you have no idea, no control over where you're inserting things, either through that biolistics method or the second method that they use to transform crops is there's a bacterium called Agrobacterium tumefaciens, and it causes crown gall disease. Well, the way that bacteria works, it's one of the few organisms in nature that the way it works is it actually inserts its DNA into the DNA of a host plant and then creates this growth on the side. So what they do is they take this Agrobacterium tumefaciens, they take the genes that are responsible for moving the genetic material, they strip out the genes that cause the disease, and in their place you can put the genes you want to move. In this case, it's an herbicide tolerant gene, and so you can use this bacterium, Agrobacterium tumefaciens, as sort of the shuttle to move the genetic material into the plant. And whether it's via the biolistics method or this method of using Agrobacterium, in both cases you have no control over where you're inserting that genetic material, and that can cause all sorts of disruption, because if the genes land in the wrong place, for example, they could shut off another gene or have all sorts of impacts. And you wouldn't know unless you looked, and that's why there should be required safety assessments.
So there you go. Next time you want to crack some genes, There you go. That's the way to do it. Okay. Right now, there's also chaos over 4 underground oil blowouts in Canada. Bad news for you pipeline fanatics. Oh, and by the way, the oil still leaks in Arkansas. And, of course, there's still an oil leak in Montana. But in Canada, underground oil spills at an Alberta oil sands operation have been going on much longer than previously thought, according to new documents. Files released to the Toronto Star show the spills were discovered 9 weeks ago, but new documents show the bitumen has been leaking since winter. Canadian Natural Resources Limited operates the Primrose Oil Sands facility 3 hours northeast of Edmonton, where 4 ongoing underground oil blowouts have contaminated forest, muskeg, lake, and have already killed dozens of animals, including beaver, duck, and birds. According to the government scientists who have been to the site, neither government nor industry are able to stop the spills. Toronto Star, July 19th, scientist who's asked not to be named for fear of losing his job, said the operation was in chaos. Everyone, the company and the government, is freaking out, he says. Nobody really understands how to stop it from leaking, or if they do, they haven't put the measures into place. It's a new kind of spill, and there's no off button, said Keith Stewart, an energy analyst with Greenpeace who teaches a course on energy policy and environment at the University of Toronto. You can't cap it like a conventional oil well, or it'll turn off a valve on a pipeline. You're pressurizing the oil bed so hard that it's no wonder it blows out. This means the oil will continue to leak until the well is no longer pressurized, which means the bitumen could be seeping from the underground areas for months. So, before I do go any further, I do also want to mention that, as always, I'm going to urge you to support our fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, is on Sunday just before us, Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women Media, Susan Nylon and her show, The Nylon Report, Sita Bigui, whose show Sita Media is on, Emily Dillick, who publishes the online Progressive Press, and Harriet Lerman, whose show The Voice of the People is heard regularly also. Okay, and now, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, we're going to go ahead and bring our first guest on. And this will be Dr. Michael Hansen of the Consumer Union and Consumer Report. Here we go. Dr. Hansen, senior scientist. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Michael Hansen of the Consumers Union, senior scientist, sir. You've been involved in the arena of investigating genetically engineered food for some time, is that correct?
That's correct.
You obviously have to have very good genetic mapping to even have a guess as to where it might be, and of course, it also seems to imply the need to be testing the results to see if it's...
Yes, because you see... When you do conventional breeding, you can think of the genome as sort of a regulated whole. So it's the genes that, you know, code for traits. They occur on specific places on, you know, chromosomes. And those places, those locations are often conserved between different species, even within and among families of plants. And so when you breed conventionally, you're not really... You're mixing chromosomes, but you're not sort of inserting these genes at random. And that's part of what the problem is. It's the technology itself can create these unintended and other consequences. And that's, you know, one of the main reasons why these foods should be required to be tested, because the technology does raise food safety issues. And as I said, there is global agreement that engineered foods are different and that safety assessments should be required. And the U.S. actually doesn't do either of those things, so we can't even meet the global standard.
Isn't it true that some of the nations of Europe have a very different perspective on regulating these genetic modified...
Not only other nations in Europe, but as I said, globally, there's been an agreement that genetically engineered foods, that genetic engineering is different than conventional breeding, that safety assessments should be required. Many countries that look at genetic engineering, they all require safety assessment. We do not. And also, there's the question of labeling. And not only does all of Europe label, but there's 64 countries around the world that require labeling. And that goes from all of Europe to, for example, China, India, Russia, Japan, Australia, Thailand, America. I mean, 64 at this point. So, again, the U.S. is the outlier on both of these issues. That is, not requiring safety assessments and not requiring labeling for these foods.
But there are many Americans who disagree with that non-labeling. How is that disagreement playing out nowadays?
Well, there's over the years, actually, between 1995 and 2011, there have, many surveys have showed between 70 and 95% of consumers want to see engineered foods labeled as such. And what that's led to is last year there was this Proposition 37 that would require labeling of engineered foods. It narrowly was defeated in California. And that's in part because the other side, which was primarily large biotechnology and other corporations, they spent about between $45 and $50 million compared to $8 million from the pro forces. And that galvanized things. Even though California lost, that actually galvanized things, so that right now there is a ballot initiative in Washington State that would require labeling that will be voted on in November. And a number of states now are trying to pass mandatory labeling laws. So the state of Connecticut has actually passed a mandatory labeling law. It's been signed by the governor. The state of Maine has also passed a mandatory labeling law that has not been signed by the governor yet, who will sign it in January. Now, both the and in Vermont, the House passed a mandatory labeling bill, and then their session ended. And so in January, the Senate in Vermont will look at, take up the issue of mandatory labeling. Now, the states of Maine and Connecticut that have passed mandatory labeling laws, they're these what are called trigger clauses. They don't go into effect until a number of other states, either four or five states, other states in the Northeast require labeling. So there is movement at the state level, and I suspect that if the ballot initiative in Washington State succeeds, there would probably be pressure to have some kind of national bill or national regulation for labeling.
But I would assume that the large corporations that fought it so stringently in California will be looking to appeal this or take it to court or go to the Supreme Court. Have you heard of any of that, that sort of strategy?
Yes. What the other side likes to say is they claim that federal government preempt labeling. That is, that if a state tried to require a labeling of engineered food, that that would violate the law. So that's why there's, in the past, when bills haven't gone through, part of the reason that when they get turned down in the states is that there could potentially be a lawsuit brought against the state by Monsanto or, you know, the biotech companies. In defense of that, of these bills, I should say that if you look at it legally, we don't believe that there's anything illegal about engineered foods being labeled at the state level, because actually the FDA doesn't formally have a legal position on genetic engineering. They say that it's not any different than conventional breeding. Right? And if that's the case, then they don't see any reason to label. And we would argue, our side, if you look at the bills that have been passed in Connecticut and Maine and the ballot initiative in Washington State, they all define genetic engineering in the same way, and they all require about the same form of labeling. And the fact that you're seeing this movement, I think, is actually very significant, because these bills have never gone forward before, and they are now. And I should point out that there was a petition a couple of years ago to the FDA to require labeling of engineered foods, and there was over a million signatures were garnered on that petition. And this year in April, when the FDA said there'd be no problem with environmentally, if they approved this engineered salmon, they got almost 2 million people signing petitions or writing to the agency saying that they don't want engineered salmon, and if it comes on the market, they want it labeled. So I think all this shows that public does want labeling, our position that these laws do not violate, that they are legal and that they don't violate the Constitution, and they're carefully written so that they don't.
It's not a sanction on trade. It's not a denial of access to the marketplace. It just says, hey, we'd like to know.
Right.
It's like a reasonable position.
That is a reasonable position, but what the other side will try to say is they'll also try to say, oh, well, these labels are served as a black mark, like a skull and crossbones, and that they imply that there's a difference in safety or that there's a difference between engineered and non-engineered foods when there actually is none. And we think that's wrong because there are differences.
You don't have to be a fan of Dr. Moreau to imagine that once this experiment gets out in the field, we've got a situation where they are rather randomly tampering with genetic material. They're not sure what's going to happen. And then they want to put this out in the environment where Mother Nature will have her way. Had there been examples of either, let's say, natural evolutionary type changes once material has been modified, and in fact, hasn't some of the insects that this has evolved to treat now evolved their own
resistance.
Thank you.
Yeah, and what you need to look is the two main traits that are out there is one is herbicide tolerance, plants that are designed to be resistant to an herbicide. Most of those are these glyphosate-tolerant plants. The trade name for that used to be called Roundup, so they're often called Roundup-ready plants. And then the other set of plants are plants that are the so-called BT plants, and those are plants that have a toxin from a soil bacterium, Bacillus thuringiensis, has actually been engineered into plants so that they'll produce this toxin that kills insects that eat it. So those are the two main traits that are out there. And to actually ask your question again.
What I was getting at is, once you let that experiment out,
So with these two traits, what has happened is, for example, if you continue to spray herbicide, plants will evolve resistance to the herbicide, and so you can create what are called super weeds. And in fact, when you have 94% of the soybeans are engineered to be tolerant to glyphosate, and you have probably 40 to 50% of the corn acreage are in Roundup Ready corn, and the major crop rotation is corn and soybeans. Well, if you plant Roundup Ready corn and then you rotate that with Roundup Ready soybeans, that means you're continuing to spray Roundup on all these crops, and you can create these super weeds, and that's just what's happened. There's an epidemic now of these super weeds, and that is weeds that are now resistant to glyphosate, and they're often resistant to all herbicides. Globally, there's now 22 species of weeds that are resistant to glyphosate. In the United States, we have 14 of those species. They're spread over 60 million farm acres are now infested, and half the farms in the U.S. are now dealing with these herbicide-tolerant weeds. That has led to, there's been an explosion in the use of herbicide. The amount of glyphosate that's sprayed has increased more than tenfold in the last 10 years. And in fact, the situation is so bad that last year, the National Academy of Sciences hosted this big meeting about what are we going to do to deal with this epidemic of these herbicide-tolerant plants. And they're all created by the overuse of herbicides. And when we look in cotton, for example, there's one of the major weed pests is called Palmer pigweed. And that is resistant to glyphosate and actually to all other herbicides. So what's happened is in parts of the South, for example, in Georgia, there's over 50,000 acres of cotton that are infested with this Palmer pigweed. There's no way to control it with herbicides, so they're going back to having to use machetes. So plants have evolved resistant to the herbicides. That's led to a dramatic increase in herbicide usage. In fact, the data has shown Dr. Charles Benbrook from Washington State University has looked at the first 16 years of engineered plants being on the market from 1995 till 2010 and has been able to show that there has been almost 500 million pounds more herbicides are being sprayed on engineered crops compared to the non-engineered counterpart. So there has been actually a huge increase in herbicide use, which has led to this explosion of herbicide tolerant weeds. So that's for the herbicide plants. Now, the plants that are BT resistant, those now insects are starting to evolve resistance. There are reports this year and last year that the BT corn for the corn rootworm is failing in parts of Iowa and Illinois. And if we look in other countries, in India, insects have evolved resistance to some of the BT cotton as well. In both these cases, with herbicide-tolerant plants, you're creating superweeds. That's already been demonstrated. And with these BT crops, the insects start to evolve resistance to the BT, so you have to then use other materials to engineer into plants. And what they're doing for the way they're dealing with herbicide-tolerant plants now that their weeds are resistant to glyphosate, well, what they're doing is they're now going to engineer the plants so that you can now spray 2,4-D on them or dicamba. And 2,4-D was one of the herbicides along with 2,4-5-T that made up Agent Orange. And so the way that the companies are dealing with the problem of herbicide-tolerant weeds is they're going to make crops now resistant to multiple herbicides.
And now that the evidence is clearly in that it's actually increased the amount of herbicide, I don't understand where the argument is to use these things.
Well, what they say is it's useful to two things. It's useful to the farmers, and the other side will try to say that there's been a huge reduction in pesticide use, and they like to refer to the BT crops because there actually has been a reduction in insecticide use in those crops, but that's been more than offset by the increase in herbicide use for the herbicide-tolerant ones. So what the industry does is they just focus on the fact that there's been a reduction of insecticide use and then try to say how these crops have reduced pesticide use, and they're selectively looking at the data.
Yeah, that's for sure. Selective use of data.
That is very true.
Many of us have heard different types of herbicides and pesticides act on different animal chemistry systems.
Mm-hmm.
The glyphosates, what part of the plant do they attack?
The way the glyphosate-tolerant plants work is normally when glyphosate is sprayed onto a plant, the way that herbicide works is it is absorbed into the leaves, it moves to the roots of the plants, and then the way it kills them is it creates this protein that glyphosate then can no longer bind to, because normally what's happening in these herbicide-tolerant crops is normally when you spray glyphosate on a plant, it moves to the roots of the plant and it interrupts the energy cycle in the plant. That's the simplest way to say it. So when you make a plant resistant to glyphosate, what you do is the way glyphosate normally works when you spray it on a plant is it attaches to something that disrupts the energy generating process in a cell. So you make a version of that substance that now glyphosate cannot bind to, so when they're sprayed on the crop, although it moves into the roots of the plant, it no longer binds or disrupts the energy generation process, and so therefore the plants are resistant. And in some crops, it looks like what's also happening is the glyphosate is streaming into the soil, and it turns out that fungi such as Fusarium, their levels increase in the presence of glyphosate in the soil like that. So these Roundup Ready crops have also been associated with increase in certain fungal diseases.
Thank you. With so much of the corn crop, the soybean crop, the canola crop impacted by these unlabeled genetic technology, what does Consumer Union, Consumer Reports suggest? Is there a way of finding products out there in the marketplace that are not
What people can do is, besides getting involved and supporting mandatory labeling at both the federal level and at the state level, if you live in one of the states that there have actually been 25 bills that were introduced in 25 different states this session. And so people can get involved there. In terms of what they buy, if you have the money, it turns out organic foods, you're not allowed to use any engineered materials in producing organic foods. So that's one thing people can do. And then there's also this non-GMO project has labels that they'll put on foods that that go through this process, and they get a label that has a seal, the non-GMO project seal on it, and that will mean that those foods have been screened and they don't either have any engineered ingredients in them, or if they do, for example, have either corn or soy, it won't be over 0.9%. And there's about now, I think, 6,000 food products that have been labeled through the non-GMO project.
Thanks,
so that's the other thing that people can do, is either buy organic or look for some of these labels, such as the non-GMO project.
What do you see as the next issue coming up in this arena, in the genetic engineered crop arena?
Oh, I think the very big thing will be whether the ballot initiative, that's I-522 in Washington State, passes. If that happens in November, you'll probably see very soon after that, sometime next year, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a move to have some kind of labeling at the national level. The other big issue will be whether they approve this genetically engineered salmon that has been engineered to supposedly grow to market weight in half the time. And there are many people that thought that that fish was going to be approved just before the July 4th recess, but that didn't happen. And so that could happen sometime in the next year, would be potential approval of an engineered fish. And that would be the first engineered animal that would be on the market. And that does raise huge issues, because people are far more concerned with about engineered animals than engineered plants. And so I think those are going to be the big issues in the next year, is the issue of labeling, both what happens in Washington State, and I think also next year we'll see Vermont will probably pass labeling in the Senate, and we might see other states pass labeling bills as well.
Do you think that engineered meat, whether it be poultry or pigs or cows, is that far away?
Poultry would be, in terms of the other ones, these after the fish, there are engineered pig that they'd like to see approved, although I should say the Canadian company that did that is sort of shut down. But that, so there are engineered pig that could be at the market, and there has been talk of engineered cattle, but they don't appear to be close to market yet.
Well, was there any final thought you want to leave us with, sir?
No, just that, just to reiterate the points that, again, there's global agreement that genetic engineering is different than conventional breeding, and that safety assessment should be required. And in the U.S., we don't do that. And in fact, we believe that genetic engineering should be required to be labeled, in part, because that would be one of the only ways that we could track any potential health problems that could come from eating these crops. Is the only way you could be able to track that is if the foods are labeled. And so that's one of actually the main arguments of why we think food should be labeled in the U.S., because not only do consumers have a right to know what they're eating, but also because this would serve as a risk management measure to deal with the scientific uncertainty. That is a way to track any potential health effects that could come from consuming these crops.
Thank you so very much, sir. Certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And have a good evening, sir.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Hansen of Consumers Union, senior scientist on the GE issue. Next, we've got Gene Economos. Gene has worked for over 25 years on issues of environmental justice, immigrant rights, and labor. Since 2007, Gene has been the Pesticide Safety and Environmental Health Project Coordinator for Farm Workers Association of Florida. She coordinates training in Florida that teaches farm workers how to identify workplace violations of worker protection standards and healthcare providers how to recognize pesticide exposure. They annually train over 500 farm workers on their rights and protections in the workplace and how to protect themselves and their families from pesticide exposure. Jeannie is engaged in local, state, national, and international coalitions and collaborations related to farm worker rights, health and safety, and pesticide reduction. From 1996 to 2001, she served as FWAW's Lake Apopka Project Coordinator, addressing the issues of job loss, displacement, and health problems of farm workers who worked on those farmlands before they were closed in 98. The bird mortality crisis in 98-99 turned her focus to pesticide-related health problems of the former Lake Apopka farm workers who had been exposed to the same damaging organochloride pesticides that were implicated in the deaths. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Gene Economos, Farm Workers Association. Gene, take it away. Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's time for Progressive News Network. And today we have a very interesting guest, someone who's concerned not just about pesticide safety, but who's also concerned about workers' rights. Let me introduce to you Ms. Jeannie Economos, who has worked for over 25 years in the field of worker rights, worker safety, pesticide safety, etc. Jeannie, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's our honor to have you. Jeannie, why don't you tell us what we need to know about things going on right now?
Well, last week, the Farm Worker Association of Florida, along with some other ally groups around the country, including Earth Justice and Farm Worker Justice, launched a campaign called the Safer Farm Workers, Families, and Food Campaign. And with this campaign, we sent 15 farm workers from around the country to Washington, D.C., to meet with congressional staffers and the EPA and the USDA to call for stronger protections for farm workers against pesticide exposure. This has been a long process. We have been waiting for 13 years for the Environmental Protection Agency to improve the standards that protect farm workers against pesticide exposure, and we just feel that we can't wait any longer. It's about time for EPA to get these standards pushed through, and this was a big effort to get farm workers to speak on their own behalf in this effort.
Well, that's wonderful. One would hope that simply the danger that these people who collect the food that we all eat, you'd think that their danger would be enough, and I'm sure you'd try to make the simultaneous case that not only is their exposure bad, but also consumers' exposure is bad too. Tell me what, you know, I've looked at some of the news stories, and it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. What kind of chemistry are they exposed to now on what amounts to a daily basis?
Well, unfortunately, farm workers work in a variety of crops, and there's a variety of different pests that affect those crops. So basically, they're pretty much exposed to a toxic soup of chemicals, both fertilizers and pesticides. And some of these pesticides that they're exposed to are known to cause long-term chronic health effects, in addition to acute effects from direct exposure. But some of these pesticides have been linked to things like Parkinson's disease, autoimmune diseases, birth defects, and even more recent studies have even linked high body burden of toxins to diabetes and arthritis and things like that. So we have some very serious issues of farm workers' long-term chronic health impacts from being exposed daily just to provide us the food that we eat every day.
Now, Jeannie, I'm sure many people have no idea what the fields look like and what kind of the experience these folks have. Correct me if I'm wrong, there's typically no way for them to rinse off or wash off so that the exposure that they have from spending their day bending over the fields or crawling among the plants, they don't have any way of really cleaning that themselves off before they get home at the end of the day. Is that correct?
Well, let me just say first of all that a lot of people, when I say the word farm worker, a lot of people don't even know what I'm talking about. They think of farmers, and they don't even have any recognition. Farm workers are still, unfortunately, the invisible ones. And so sometimes we have to just even educate people about what farm workers, who they are. And these are the people that are allowing us to have an abundant and cheap food supply. And they are exposed to all kinds of risks. there are regulations that were started in the mid-1990s that farms are required to have hand-washing water, soap, towels, paper towels, and things like that. Those are part of the regulations, and part of the regulations, those are field sanitation laws. The problem is that even though these laws exist on the books, we find that there's very often violations, both of the field sanitation laws and the worker protection standards. Let me just tell you a quick case.
Please do.
I work in the Apopka area, and about 4 months ago, we did a pesticide training for some farm workers in the town of Zellwood. And a couple of days after we did the pesticide training, one of the farm workers called me up and said that he had had some serious symptoms from being exposed to pesticides. So he came in and we had a talk, and I reported to the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health his symptoms, and that there were violations of the worker protection standards in his workplace. He worked at a nursery in Central Florida. His symptoms included dizziness, headaches, including a brief period of unconsciousness. That's pretty serious exposure, pretty serious symptoms. We made the report, and just 2 days ago, I got the report of the investigation and the inspection of the nursery back, and I was appalled. I have to say I'm really outraged today, because the report that I got back was that they found 7 counts of violations of the worker protection standards at this nursery. The nursery was fined $4,000. But then the conclusion was that they could not link the workers' symptoms to pesticide exposure, in spite of the fact that he had all these symptoms and there were all these violations. And I just think it's an outrage. What do we have to do? What do farm workers have to go through in order to get documentation, recognition that their health symptoms are related to their exposure to pesticides in the workplace? A $4,000 fine for Florida, that's good. But how good is that, that this nursery should be fined $4,000 when this gentleman's health could be at risk long-term because of his exposure? It's just an outrage, and we need to change it.
You're absolutely right. I just recently saw the Gasland 2 movie, and one of the things that they mention there is that the EPA, after doing the studies that show the danger to people who just live in the area where this fracking is going on, they backed off any kind of constraint, any kind of punishment, any kind of sanction. And basically, off the record, the scientists told the people that live in these places, don't drink the water. It's deadly poison. But we can't do anything about it. In a climate of deregulation where, I'm just going to say, the Republicans basically see no regulation that should be enforced. They're talking about gutting the EPA. I'm afraid that we're all in great danger. And unfortunately, our friends in the farm workers are on the front lines of this.
Exactly. And I did see Gasland 2 also. And I've been doing environmental and environmental justice work for many years. And in spite of that, I was really shocked at what I learned about in Gasland. But it is indicative of just how corporations have a stranglehold on our government, our economy, and our personal lives. And the only way that we're going to get change is if we all stand up. We can't stand up just as individuals, although we have to do that too, but we have to stand up together. One of the things that I say to farm workers when we do our pesticide trainings and our other trainings is that we're much more than individuals. We're a community. And the only way that we're going to make significant change is if we act as a community and fight for our rights. And that's one of the things that we're doing right now with this campaign and with our efforts last week in Washington, D.C., which will be ongoing both on the statewide level and on a national level. And we invite everybody to join us. One more thing I'd like to say. I use the term farm workers, and I think sometimes that makes it too easy for people to lump people into a category and then just ignore them. But when you say farm workers and translate that into men and women and children, I think it helps personalize it. It helps humanize the people that are doing this work, because they are. They're families. They're men and women and children that are working in these fields. Men, women, and children should not be subjected to these conditions. They're workers, they're farm workers, but they're men and women and children. They have rich lives, they have rich culture, they have rich heritage, and we need to acknowledge that, respect it, and give them the proper treatment and protections that they deserve.
I lived for about 30 years just a few blocks from fields in the Homestead Redlands area, and I saw the kind of working conditions that these folks were in every day. There was a series of reports, I think it was last year, about some of the birth defect impacts. Are you familiar with any of the statistics on that part of the problem?
Well, there aren't, unfortunately. It's a problem of both the agencies and our system, but there are no good statistics that are being captured about farm workers and birth defects, although there has been increasing science that link different pesticides to birth defects. But there was a case that got nationwide attention in 2004 of farm workers in Immokalee. Three farm worker women gave birth to babies with serious birth defects all within a short period of time. And all of them had worked at the same farm in tomatoes. And all of them had worked in the fields and were exposed to pesticides while they were pregnant. That was a similar case. The fact that the farm was fined thousands of dollars for violations of these regulations, and then the Department of Agriculture that levied the fines, they came around and reduced the fines drastically. And so the families were left with babies with birth defects. One of the babies died. The other two survived. But that doesn't compensate the families for what they have gone through, both in their own personal health and the health of their children. Carlitos was the most famous case. He was a baby born with no arms and no legs. That family was able to get a civil suit against the company, and they were able to get some compensation. But there are many other cases that don't get that kind of high-profile attention, that go unreported, unrecognized, and the families have to suffer. I think one important finding that's come out over the past few years links especially organophosphates and a particular pesticide called chlorpyrifos, which is very commonly used. They are now linked to long-term impacts on the second generation, including ADHD and learning disabilities. So if you're a farm worker and your child is born with learning disabilities, how do you prove it? And then how do you get help for your family?
For those of us who are familiar a little even to this situation, it's obvious, but these people are typically have no health care, no benefits whatsoever as part of their working relationship with the farm industry that they're working for. So they're really on their own. And since so many, educated Americans are unfamiliar with some of the pesticides being applied to their food, one has to imagine that some of these people are just not aware. I understand you've been very involved in educating farm workers on some of the dangers and how they can best protect themselves while they're in the field. Could you talk about your education programs?
Yes, we have a pesticide health and safety training program. The training was developed by the Farm Worker Health and Safety Institute, and we train a minimum of 500 farm workers every year on how to protect themselves, things like washing your clothes separately from your family's laundry so you don't contaminate your laundry with pesticides, things about the proper clothes to wear to protect yourselves in the fields, like such as long-sleeve shirts and plastic or rubber boots. and different things like that. So we do these trainings, and the farm workers are really appreciative, and it does help them. However, we were doing a focus group once with some farm workers, and one of the women had taken our training before, and at the end of the focus group she said, "Well, you know, I do all that. I wear the long sleeve shirts and hat and gloves," she said, "but we still have to breathe the air."
Yeah.
And I didn't have an answer for that, because that's so true. And you're right, most of these farm workers do not have health insurance through their employer. Florida tends to be different than other states because of our climate. A lot of farm workers can work here 9 months out of the year, and if they're in nurseries and ferneries, they can even work almost year-round. So we have a lot of seasonal farm workers here that don't necessarily travel the seasons. So they're residents in this area. They have extended family. They have roots in the community, but a lot of them are undocumented. And I will say that it is inherent in our agricultural system to always be looking for a cheap, exploitable labor force to harvest the food that we eat. There are only two classes of workers in the United States that are not covered under the same laws that protect other workers, and that's farm workers and domestic workers. It took a while for it to dawn on me, but when I finally realized, I thought, well, you know, that's what the slaves did back in slavery times. They worked on the plantations, and they worked as, you know, the domestics in the plantation owners' homes. So those two occupations are living the legacy of slavery. Our laws have not advanced significantly from those times, and the system of agriculture is always looking for a cheaper labor force. For many generations, it was African Americans that did agriculture in this country, until African Americans began to know their rights. With the civil rights movement, they were able to have other opportunities for other education and jobs. During World War II, when a lot of African Americans went overseas to fight, those were two periods of times when the United States looked for agricultural workers from Mexico and Central and South America. So you cannot talk about agriculture and pesticide exposure without also making the link to immigration, because, again, it's inherent. The system of injustice is inherent. It's a systemic problem within our system of agriculture. Right now, while a lot of the Hispanics are becoming more knowledgeable about their rights, and so we have found cases of farms that are trying to get guest workers from places like Thailand and the Philippines to come harvest our food, places where people are even more vulnerable and have less support network in the United States, know less about their rights, and have less language capability. So I think the things are connected. I know we're talking about pesticides, but I think it's all connected to look at the system of injustice that farm workers are
facing. I do want to touch on immigration and immigration policy with some of the things going on in Congress right now, but I want to ask you one more question about the pesticides. I'm sure as part of your education to inform these folks of how they can best protect themselves, part of the discussion deals with, if you will, the stickiness of these pesticides, that they're not typically water soluble, that they're very difficult to clean. Could you address that?
And there's all different kinds. There's pesticides that are gases, there's pesticides that are liquid, and some that are a little pellets that are applied on the plants. When we do pesticide trainings, we have a little skit that we do, and we take baby powder and we shake it onto the plastic fruits and vegetables that we have as part of the training, and we talk to the farm workers about the residue, the powdery substance that's on the fruits and vegetables or the leaves of the plant, is the residue of the dried pesticide, and that is sticky on the plants. And even though the pesticide may be dry and technically considered safe and not in its very active phase, if you're in working with the plants all day long, you are getting that residue on your clothes, you're getting that residue on your hands and your hair, on your skin, and farm workers risk getting exposed to that even if they don't wash their hands before they eat, before they smoke a cigarette, if they touch their hair. So it's really critical. We tell farm workers that it's really important for them to take off all their clothes and put on clean clothes before they pick up their children when they go home.
Yeah, exactly what I was
thinking. And even ideally, they should take a shower and wash their hair before they even touch their children, before they walk in the house, because they track pesticides into the home. There have been some studies that have looked at pesticide residues in homes. They have not been significant studies. There needs to be more studies of that with broader populations. But, you know, that's another thing, that you can do swabs in homes and find that pesticides are, on furniture in the household, because parents bring that in. Another big problem in Florida and other places, but in Immokalee, for example, or in the town of Pearson, farm worker homes are oftentimes immediately across the street.
Sure.
From farms or nurseries or ferneries. In one place in Immokalee, there's about 10 trailers that are surrounded on three sides by farmland. Well, children live in those trailers and they go outside to play. So the people are exposed not only at work, but oftentimes if they live in these areas, they can also be exposed in their homes and by bringing pesticides home on their clothes and bodies.
Thank you so much. But before I let you sign off, I want you to tell our audience, if they want to help, how can they get in touch with you? How can they get in touch with the program? What can they do to help?
They can call our office. Our office number is 407-886-5151. Our website is floridafarmworkers.org. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. And they can contact me personally. My email is farmworker@AOL.com. And we invite everybody to come join us, because we are a community, and an injustice against one is an injustice against all of us. So we hope that you'll join us in fighting for justice.
Thank you so very much, Jeannie, and best of luck with the wonderful work that you're doing.
Thank you. We really appreciate your having us on this show. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeannie. Bye-bye. Well, next up, my friends, we have the author of Foodopoly, Ms. Winona Howder, is also the executive director of Food and Water Watch. And this is going to be one very interesting interview. I think you'll really find a lot of it very, very useful. Ms. Winona Howder. And today I'm welcoming our guest, Ms. Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, it's our honor to have you with us. You are doing such a great service for American consumers. Let's hope that more of them get a chance to profit from your wisdom. Winona, why don't you tell us what's going on right now? What's some of the latest news on the centralized control of all food sources for American consumers?
Well, you know, we have only 20 food processing companies that control most of the brands in the grocery store. So Americans go into the store and they think they have a lot of choice and a lot of diversity. But really, there are just these few companies that now have so much political power that they are really able to dictate almost everything about our food system. And I think we're seeing a lot of the impacts of that today. For instance, poultry. Tyson is the fourth largest food processing company in the country. And the giant Brazilian meat company, JBS, is the fifth largest processing company in the country. They own brands like Pilgrim's Pride and Swift. And these companies have been able to use their political power to attempt to get the USDA to allow chickens to be slaughtered at 175 birds per minute. And that means that the slaughter lines move so quickly that a lot of the fecal matter gets on the carcass of the bird. And then the companies dip the carcasses in chlorine solutions and trisodium phosphate to kill the bacteria. I don't think most Americans want to eat fecal matter, even if it's not going to poison them. And of course, sometimes the bacteria does remain on the meat, and people do get sick.
You know, I never noticed that on the labels, dipped in chlorine and trisodium phosphate, now with fecal material.
And that's right. You know, that is not on the label. And one of the interesting things about poultry is, really, since the late 1970s, the poultry industry has been able to have weight in their meat. So they're able to keep that water content in the meat, so the consumer is actually paying for the pleasure of having some of that chlorine or trisodium phosphate wash in the poultry that they're eating.
Since so many of us are, let's be generous and say, a little skeptical about the FDA's, the quality of their oversight. Could you talk about that? Could you talk about what's going on with the FDA? Are they enforcing? Are they backing off? So many times we hear about environmental regulations being basically, you know, look the other way.
Right. Well, we have two agencies that are in charge of protecting Americans from food safety disasters. The first is the USDA that does the inspection around meat products. And then the FDA does the inspection around all other foods. And so what we've seen is that in the USDA, they are actually trying to hold back the meat inspectors from doing a thorough job in inspecting meat products. And over, really, it started with the Clinton administration, where they privatized inspection in processing, and now they're trying to allow meat companies to do self-inspection in the slaughter step as well. And the meat companies have an enormous amount of political power, and they're able to put a lot of pressure on the USDA. And so the agency, rather than giving the scrutiny to these huge processing plants where most meat is produced, it's a lot easier to pick on the smaller processing plants. And I think that's one of the problems that we see. Now, at the FDA, they have even fewer inspectors than at the USDA, and less than 1% of meat or of food products coming in from overseas, for instance, actually get an inspection. And one of the major problems that we have today is that so much of our food is imported because of the trade agreements and because the food processing companies want to produce food products where it's cheapest, where labor is cheaper. So especially produce and processed food is coming in from overseas. Even China has become a major importer into the United States of food products. For processed fruits and vegetables, they're about the largest or third largest importer today. So the fact that we have very weak regulations and not enough inspectors at the FDA is really affecting our food system. And you may remember a couple years ago, there was a Food Safety Modernization Act that was passed, and those rules are still being finalized. And actually, this week, the FDA is coming out with a suggested rule around imported food. I think it came out today, and it's hundreds of pages long. Now, we're just taking a look at it today, but even if the rule actually is
enforced,
is strict, which I doubt, we're not going to have enough inspectors to actually enforce it, and it won't be enforced. And so I think Americans should be very concerned about imported food and the fact that there's a trade agreement that's being negotiated now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
yes,
that
TPP.
Will allow even more favorable conditions for importing more food.
We heard some time ago about, was it hundreds or thousands of hogs being found in a river in China? Did you ever hear what the impetus for that was? What were they poisoned by? And should we expect that pork to be shipped to the United States?
Well, I do know about the incident, and as far as I know, we never heard what caused the death of those hogs. But we do know that a major merger is going on today where the largest hog company in China is purchasing Smithfield, and that merger does not bode well for consumers.
You have a wonderful book, Foodopoly, that's to help inform consumers about, let's just say, the issues around food safety. Why don't you talk about Foodopoly?
Well, I wrote Foodopoly because I think that there just is not enough information about why people should be concerned with how the food industry has been concentrated in the hands of just a few companies. Decisions were made after World War II that there were too many farmers and that really food production should be vertically integrated and that it was more efficient to allow capital to replace labor and the chemicals could replace labor. And so a number of policy decisions were made over a 40-year period that have resulted in this consolidation that we have today. And it really speeded up in the early 1980s when the Reagan administration came into office and eviscerated our antitrust laws. And then the Clinton administration also helped this consolidation along by supporting the trade liberalization and the continued deregulation. And so we're left now with these few companies that are so large and have so much political power that they are just able to dictate everything about our food system. And I think if we're really going to change this, people have to understand that these problems are deeper than subsidies or that we're going to be able to fix them with one farm bill. This is really about understanding what's happened to our democracy and trying to take back control of it, because I think this monopolization has also had an effect on our economy and really is the root of a lot of problems that we see across the board today, with a lack of jobs, to the stark difference between the very wealthy and the declining middle class, and also, of course, about our food system that is pretty much dysfunctional. And Foodopoly tells the story, and I try to tell it in a way that makes it interesting and that also gives people hope that we can actually do something about it.
One of the things that seems to also come into play with sequestering the deregulation fever that seems to have struck so many on the conservative side of the table, let's say, we've seen a rise in citizen journalism, but it seems that Big Ag has a response to citizen journalism, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. We've seen across the country that ALEC, which is the right-wing association that helps promote their agenda at state legislatures, they came up with a model piece of legislation that has resulted in what we call ag gag laws, and this legislation is directed at individuals, activists who go out and take pictures of the pollution from factory farms or who go into slaughter facilities and show the abuse that's going on there. And this legislation is directed at preventing these activities. And more than 20 states have considered these ag gag laws, which we believe in the long term should not stand up in court.
You know, we find ourselves in a situation where consumers are increasingly more conscious about what they eat and what the status of the food they eat. And I think your book, Foodopoly, does a great deal toward helping them understand the underlying structural issues that are essentially tainting the food supply. Could you talk just a little bit about your work with Food and Water Watch?
Yes. Food and Water Watch is a consumer advocacy group that's a little different than most public interest organizations. We really believe that it's a grassroots uprising that's going to be able to take back our democracy, and that we really need to involve large numbers of people in the political system, because it's great if we vote with our fork. We should vote with our fork. We need to vote with our vote. And then we need to hold the elected officials accountable. And to do that is going to take many, many people being involved. So we've put our resources into state offices where we can work with grassroots organizations and individuals to try to impact state regulation and laws. Because one of the things that we see is that Congress has become so dysfunctional because of what's happened at the state level. We really need to link the issues that people are interested in with what state legislators are doing, because when you get state legislators elected who don't represent the views of their constituents, you end up with the situation that we have in Congress today, because every 10 years the state legislatures do the redistricting, and they can gerrymander a state so that they can elect the kind of candidates that have the set of values and beliefs that they want. And so in any number of states, we're seeing people sent to Congress who don't really represent their constituents or the beliefs of most Americans.
I was looking at your website, the Food and Water Watch Show, .org, and there are some just tremendous tools there and resources, documents on tap water safety and smart seafood and the Global Grocer and Metrix and access to films and a water forum, what you can do about Tricasin and the story of bottled water. These are just tremendous resources. I hope that from your book of Foodopoly, more people will be familiar with these resources that you bring and make available. I think it's tremendous.
We really hope so, because, you know, we have to all work together to really reclaim our democracy and to have the kind of world that we want. And I think that one of the ways that people can become informed is through websites like Food and Water Watch. And what we do at Food and Water Watch is we believe that, yes, we have to become informed and educated, but then we need to be able to take action. And we try to give people an avenue to take action that is meaningful and that is respectful of their time. So no matter how busy you are, there's something that you can do. And on our website, there's a way to join our listservs. You can take action on these important types of public policies that are being debated and stay informed about them. And if you have time to become more involved, there are ways that you can work on a deeper level with us. So I urge everybody to go to our website. In fact, we would love you to become a member of Food and Water Watch. And you know, our website at foodandwaterwatch.org has a lot of information about the things that we're talking about today.
I'm sure that you folks, the Food and Water Watch, has not only a reach out to consumers, but has a reach out to some members of Congress that might actually be attentive to real-world concerns about food safety. Although I can see in some of what we might call the more agricultural-based states, big business probably has its tentacles around their wallets. Are there any anybody in Congress who's been supportive and attentive to Food and Water Watch's issues?
Well, you know, I think that we have legislators around the country who, if their constituents put enough pressure on them, that they react. Now, of course, there are always some champions like Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro in New Jersey, like Senator Tester in Montana, who's done so much on some of the issues related to consolidation and genetic engineering. And, I think that what we need to do in every state is to really learn to know our legislators and to work with other citizens to try to make it possible for those legislators to take the stand that they should, because that really takes not only putting pressure on them, but organizing other people to also be aware of what's going on. And the way that our political system works today, where we basically have this system of legalized bribery, we're really in a position where we have to make our legislators do the right thing. They have to see that they have no other choice if they want to be reelected.
Well, Ms. Howder, where could people find your book, Foodopoly?
Well, they can go to the foodopoly.org website and see the list of places. They can go to any independent bookstore. Even Barnes & Noble is carrying Foodopoly or can order it. And then, of course, there is Amazon for those people who read on Kindle.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I certainly appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Not to keep any dead air in between, we've got Jeff Rooks, who's been the executive director of PEER, which is Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, a whistleblower organization. He's been executive director since 1997 with Jeff DeBonis. He helped to start PEER and for the first 4 years served as general counsel and program director. Prior to that, Jeff was policy director and staff attorney at the Government Accountability Project, representing whistleblowers from both public and private sector. Before coming to D.C., Jeff worked in California state government for 17 years, mostly in state legislature as counsel to various committees, where he drafted literally hundreds of laws on topics ranging from energy conservation to the rights of employed inventors. Jeff serves stints as deputy district attorney, an appellate court clerk, and a graduate of the California Correctional Officers Academy. And here we go with Mr. Jeff Rooks. I'd like to introduce Mr. Jeff Rook, who has been executive director of PEER since 1997. With Jeff DeBonis, he helped start PEER and for the first 4 years served as general counsel and program director. Ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome Mr. Rooks.
How are you?
Very good, sir. Very good. And yourself?
I'm great.
Oh, that's great. One of the questions I like to ask my guests is, clearly you're a person who has dedicated your life and your career helping whistleblowers get their information out. Clearly you're a person who's dedicated your life to seeing that the truth will out. Can I ask you a little bit about yourself? What in your background made you be a person who really wants to contribute over and above the call of duty?
Well, I don't know about over and above the call of duty, but I remember working in a political situation and finding myself in whistleblower straits where I was fired for not doing something I considered to be unethical. And that stayed with me, and I'm a lawyer, work in labor law, and I began to see the strategic benefit of whistleblowers. And I used to be the policy director of a group called the Government Accountability Project, which is a whistleblower law firm.
Right.
And it was like working in a legal mass unit, because you'd get calls from Veterans Affairs, from corporations, from state and local government, and they were kind of emergency calls, like, I just reported something, I've been fired, help put me back together again. And it was like practicing emergency room law. And one of the clients they represented was a group of Forest Service employees who had banded together collectively and were using the organization as a way to help reform the agency from the inside. And working as the lawyer with those people, I was struck that you had the opportunity to practice what I call preventative law, so that you weren't always fighting inside somebody's personnel jacket. You were delivering the message, in many cases, divorced from the messenger to the agency. And when the agency isn't allowed to change the subject and has to respond to the issue and not blame it on a particular disgruntled employee, you've already won half the battle. It's the terrain you want to be on. And so the effort was made to extend this beyond the Forest Service and Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, which creates a mercifully pronounceable acronym, PEER, was born. But it's also sort of a double entendre in that not only are we looking into the agencies, but also is to convey to staff that they're equal, that they have a place at the table. We often joke that in many of these public agencies, staff is spelled with a PH as if they're a lower-level life form. And in essence, they're really the experts, and there are about 250,000 environmental specialists working in the United States, many of whom don't think that they are able to do their job and serve the public as well as they could. And we're the vehicle by which they better serve you, or as we say, we defend those who defend the environment.
There's so many examples out there. We find ourselves in a dubious
situation.
I'm sorry, sir?
Business is brisk.
Yeah, it's a growth industry. You know, we find ourselves in a situation where while the statute seems to suggest that there are more protections for whistleblowers, everywhere we look, we see whistleblowers being prosecuted to the 49th degree. How do you make sense of this?
Well, there's often a disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality, and that's been more true with the Obama administration than we expected. So
gently
there's
put,
a lot of sort of lofty things, but then in terms of what happens in the trenches, not much has changed except there's kind of a deeper level of hypocrisy around it. Blowing the whistle publicly is never a career-advancing move. And also, I can't think of an example, certainly in this administration, where somebody who blew the whistle on somebody, somebody who took a career risk to try and solve a problem, never is then put in charge of that program to basically vindicate what they started to be. And in many cases, they're the ones that are most qualified to turn these agencies around. They're universally pariahs, which is why, while we do whistleblower defense, we try and avoid having people be in those situations. I call it talking down jumpers. That's one of the best things we do. Instead, we try and work with employees to figure out a way to deliver, as I said, the message without the messenger. And symbolic of the way we operate, the only product we sell our boxer shorts that say undercover activist on the butt and our logo on the leg so you can safely wear them to work.
That's funny.
The best, most effective activists are ones that are not known by the agency. In many cases, they're the ones that are in charge of designing the damage control to their own charges. And it's also one of the reasons we do an awful lot of Freedom of Information Act work, including a lot of FOIA litigation, because as an alternative to somebody coming forward with the documents, they instead just point us to the documents, and we go get them. And we then engage in a public fight with their agency to deliver what are now secret documents. And it's a battle that a lot of reporters can understand because they have similar frustrations. And when the documents finally are revealed, you've effectively put pressure on the agency to address what the documents show, but it's done in a way in which the true source is on the seabed while the battle takes place on the surface of the ocean.
Sure. That's assuming you can actually get at the information. I know in my...
That's why we sue a lot. We filed a Freedom of Information Act suit once every 3 weeks.
Luckily, we have a transparent administration who supports whistleblowers now, so your work must be so much easier. You know, we are faced with so many rather curious dilemmas environmentally right now. We've got this decision on the pipeline issue. You know, here in an open and free society where truth and openness is valued, we find ourselves in a situation where when there's an oil spill in Arkansas, the FAA declares it a no-fly zone so that reporters can't monitor what's going on. The press is stopped from even walking the shoreline on the Gulf of Mexico. Do you...
And in some part, those operations are run by the corporations that cause them. So we're working right now with one of the most obscure, important agencies called the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA.
Boy, I bet they're lavishly funded.
And they're the ones that are supposed to be in charge of the network of pipelines that would, in the U.S., the network would wrap around the circumference of the Earth 25 times and could take us close to the sun. But for the most part, it's a sleepy little agency that's industry dominated, and when there is a major incident, for the most part, the response is to get out of the way, to let the corporation solve it with almost no public oversight.
I won't ask you to talk about any of your current cases, but could you talk about one that was successfully resolved, maybe?
Sure. On the personnel side, we just got, I think, the largest publicly known settlement in a whistleblower case out of OSHA. The person who was their record-keeping expert was fired after he testified about how the system didn't work. On the individual level, in terms of kind of reforms, things like the lead paint repair and renovation rules were a result of whistleblowers inside EPA that pointed out that the agency had basically sat on their hands for a decade and not implemented the rules that addressed the last major pathway of exposure to American youth. An estimated 1.4 million kids in the country are exposed to lead dust in perilous levels due to faulty repairs and renovations. So armed with that insight, we were able to sue the agency and force them to finally act on the regulations which are now in place.
In an era of sequester and deregulation, I think there's probably little for a consumer to assume except that they're under greater risk every day. You know, the fox is guarding the chicken coop.
Well, the situation is certainly uneven, not only from agency to agency, but also even within the same agency from appointee to appointee. So there's no quality control is not the strong suit here.
There was a citizen scientific project that the state of Florida offered. You could do collect water samples and do filtration exercises in local lakes and estuaries and waterways. So I was turning in these samples every month for about 2 years, and I asked the limnologist who was in charge of it in our area. I said, so I think it's wonderful, and I'm a big fan of data collection because without the data, you can't draw any conclusions. Otherwise, you're just blue skying it. But I was wondering, are these records going anywhere? And he said, well, you know, as a matter of fact, they are. Because, well, I could give you an example. He said, one of the waterways right near a large landfill, there's a science student who's been taking samples there, and he was able to test it, and he's shown that the ammonia level, now, of course, this is a perfectly safe landfill, the county will assure you. It's lined and there's no leakage. But a canal immediately south of this landfill, which leads right into the National Park, Biscayne Bay, had ammonia levels in it 2,000 times the legal limit. And he said, see, so things are happening. And I said, well, let me ask you this. You're the water scientist. Have you reported this to anybody, or is it just going to be a science experiment at a local science fair? He said, do you really think I should, report it? Who would I report it to? Now, this is the state limnologist who's responsible for this study. I said, well, you could call Solid Waste and let them know that their landfill is leaking. You could call the EPA and say that there's a pollution source going into the national park. You could call the national park. You could call the State Department of Environmental Regulation. You can call any of these people. You really think I should? And I said, well, you're in the unique position of actually having the information. If the information doesn't go anywhere, then it's not doing any good. He said, well, tell you what, I'll tell somebody, and I won't tell them that you told me to. And I thought, how curious is that? His first reaction is, A, I have no idea who to turn into, and then B, he'll protect. And I thought that was illustrative of, you know, what passes for common science nowadays.
Florida is particularly challenging. As we've discussed, we have a Florida chapter out of Tallahassee run by a former enforcement attorney in the DEP named Jerry Phillip, and you can find his information on our website, which is peer.org, and he could tell you stories on that same subject of how the state has purged its own laboratories.
Right, right.
To make sure that certain results are not reported to anybody.
Right.
And so Florida is a state in which basic math is dangerous. So we're deeply respectful of the challenges down there, and there is so much at stake. So it's one of the great ironies.
I was producing a TV show on sports fishing. It's very popular on this part of the coast. And I asked a local wildlife officer, I said, so tell me, who's the state biologist in charge of water chemistry? He said, oh, listen, you'll never get him on the show. And I said, why is that? And he said, oh, well, they don't ever let him out of the labs. He never does any public statements. And I said, well, I can imagine why. So when I did track him down and got him to agree to an interview, the host and hostess of my show said they would never appear on a show where a water chemist was involved. Because they knew intuitively that since the county had just declared one of our local waterways so polluted that you shouldn't even touch it, that he might raise questions about the safety of food taken from the sea. And he made a statement on air that the only fish that he thought were safe to eat were dolphins because for some reason they don't bioaccumulate mercury. They weren't sure why, but that was the only sports fish that didn't accumulate mercury. Everything else, he said, was inedible as far as he was concerned, fresh and salt. And I thought, my goodness, you know, if this was known, one of two things would happen. Either, of course, they'd discredit the guy and drive him out of town, or maybe we could do something about the point sources of mercury pollution. But it's a very difficult state to work in when you're talking about quality. Whenever they have a public official who's performing very well, he's typically replaced with somebody who will not quite do so much good. Let me ask you another question.
And I was going to just interject that one of the motifs that transcends Florida is the Roberts Supreme Court in Samuel Alito's first swing decision ruled that government employees at all levels have no First Amendment rights, when they're within the scope of duty, and the rationale is that the government owns their speech. And
wow.
So the sort of mistaken notion that people that work for you, in essence the public, have First Amendment rights is no longer true and has not been true for now almost close to a decade. This decision was in 2006. And it's one of the reasons that mechanisms like our organization become even more important, because in order for these public servants to communicate with their true employers, you, they have to step outside of their role as government employees, and in many instances they need some help doing that.
Wow. That's
it's challenging. And it's especially difficult for scientists, because the only remaining legal protection for them are whistleblower statutes, and a lot of times scientists who are reporting that studies are suppressed or that a methodology was skewed or that a key finding was taken out aren't reporting a violation of law, rule, regulation, gross waste or mismanagement, or imminent danger to public health. They're reporting faulty science, and generally speaking, and it's often said, you're entitled to your own opinion but not to your own set of facts. That's not true in government.
You're not allowed the facts either.
There's no rule, for the most part, against it. To some extent, that's changing at the federal level, but if you're following our website, you'll see that those changes are slow and uneven.
Well, you know, we've had some interesting decisions with the increased radiation on the West Coast. We have upped our local radiation safety level. You can have more radiation now since there's more radiation. And I understand that fracking water has just been approved for drinking. So that's another interesting aspect.
Well, sort of yes and no. On the fracking water, and that is one of our cases, the chemicals that are introduced into these drilling shafts in the
secret chemistry
are not. Yeah, well, it's, no one knows what they are. In the East, they're not supposed to be discharged to the surface. They're supposed to be segregated and stored, which creates its own set of problems. In the West, since 1979, what's called produced water is allowed to be pumped out onto the surface. And the idea was, it's arid out there, the water, it's just underground water, there's no problem with it, and it's important for livestock and wildlife. And what's happened in recent years is that the produced water is now supplemented by an array of added chemicals. And so we got involved on discharge permits in an Indian reservation in Wyoming, where EPA, in essence, was allowing the fracking and maintenance fluids, all of which are highly toxic, to be discharged. Despite a lot of evidence that animals that drink it in any kind of quantity die or are rendered sterile or in some way are harmed. And so we're trying to, in essence, fight for the soul of EPA on this issue. And we know internally there's an awful lot of disagreement, and the fact that the permit didn't mention this was a function of an internal fight where EPA, while some Republicans characterize it as an out-of-control regulator, on issues like fracking is afraid of its own shadow. And we're trying to excise the issue so it wouldn't be discussed and there wouldn't be controversy.
Have you seen the film Fracking 2.0?
No.
One of the pieces that was aired in there, they were saying that while the local EPA scientists that were working on the Pavilion, Wyoming project could not formally say that the water was unsafe, that these people were living in areas where it was unsafe to live because of the gases being the gases leaking to the surface. But they said off the record to these people, "My God, get out of here. Don't drink the water. It's terrible." This privatization of the truth, this outlawing of any released information because of we have to protect the delicate sensibilities of Republicans, this seems to me to be the trend of the time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Bush years were challenging in their own way. They're sort of, it's a different configuration, though some of the patterns remain the same. And we were surprised because we thought this administration was going to be different, and it is different, but not in the ways that we had expected and hoped.
Right. I absolutely have to applaud your optimism and the good work that you're doing to protect whistleblowers. Number one, why don't you tell our audience how they can get in touch with you, how they can support the organization, peer.org. Are there ways that the public can help?
Sure. If you go to peer.org, you'll find an array of information that's divided by state and agency, as well as opportunities to contribute, buy underwear, pick up kits of information that can help individual employees see the whistleblower law in your state, look at all the scientific integrity policies, basically everything you'd want to know about this subject and things you've never heard of that are coming out of these agencies are available at peer.org.
Well, sir, thank you so very much for joining us. We owe organizations like yours so very much. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, our final guest of the evening from the Organic Consumers Association is the Assistant Media Director, Mr. Zach Kaldvir. Zach, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Organic Consumers Association and the work that you do?
Sure. We are certainly a grassroots nonprofit public interest organization, and our primary focuses are on, I would say, health, justice, and sustainability. So in particular, that means issues related to food safety, industrial agriculture, genetic engineering, children's health, corporate accountability, and fair trade. And we are about over a million members strong when you factor in everybody that takes action, that's on our email list, and that donate.
Many of us have been concerned for some time, some of us even decades, about the state of our food safety. And many of us have turned for years to what's called organic foods. We know there's a little bit of definitional questions there. How does Organic Consumer Association define organic food?
Well, organic food is food that does not require and does not use any kind of pesticides, herbicides, synthetic fertilizers. Certainly the animals are hormone and antibiotic free. It's grown and in sustainable practices, and it requires a significant amount of regulation and oversight to ensure that companies comply with all the standards that require to be organic, because organic food is different in fundamental way in every step from the farm to the dinner plate. Every step is completely different than our current conventional food system, which is based on all that is different than organic, which is genetically engineered, highly saturated in toxic herbicides and pesticides, then highly mechanized and processed using all kinds of different chemicals and additives, and it's really high in salt, calories, and fat. And so it's really an entirely different way of growing food. The food itself is different, and also the entire economics behind organic food is different. It doesn't rely on giant corporations and food monopolies or biotech and pesticide companies. It's really about small and medium-sized farmers growing food in a way that's sustainable, healthy, and is can provide an honest living for farmers without having to be under the gun of Monsanto.
You know, one of the things that to me just raises red flags. If you've got a process that they have to make secret, you got to wonder why they're doing it. And when we hear about the ag gag laws, that I think takes, for any consumer who thinks about it, and takes a suspect industry and drives it off a cliff.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. For those who don't know about the ag gag laws that have been pushed in a number of different states and actually been successful in a few, is essentially criminalizing whistleblowers that might simply have some footage, show some footage of the horrific abuses and treatment of animals at these giant factory farms, which, you know, a lot of scientists have called them mini Chernobyls, because factory farms are so toxic, so polluting to our water, to our soil, and to the animals that we end up eating. And so I would agree, anybody should be seriously concerned when corporations are so afraid of basic transparency, especially our basic right to know what's in the food that we eat and what we're putting in our bodies. I mean, that's a fundamental right. And for them to be so dedicated to preventing us from knowing just basic what they're doing tells us all we need to know about our current food system, which has been essentially monopolized in similar ways. And you see the same kinds of practices by the banks or the health insurance industry. Just like those industries were not monopolized, so too has our food system. And that means that this kind of corruption and abuse of power and lack of transparency is inevitable, and that's what we're seeing now.
You know, we had guests tonight from Consumers Union, Consumer Reports, Farm Workers Association, Food and Water Watch, PEER, and basically every person has said the system doesn't work. The system right now is producing food that's just not safe.
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of extraordinary. The more you look into this issue, and it's really disturbing, because what we have done is, first of all, we've handed over the reins of our food system, literally ownership, patent rights over our food, and to companies like Monsanto and DuPont. And these are corporations, people should remember, that created Agent Orange, DDT, PCBs, you know, cigarettes. And these companies, throughout the 20th century, Monsanto in particular, told us for decades that each of these products that they were manufacturing were safe, when in reality they knew that it was resulting in the death and illness of millions of human beings, including hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese that are still fourth generation being born with birth defects due to Agent Orange. Now these companies control 80% of our food supply system, including the seeds and then the pesticides and herbicides that these seeds require. And, you know, they're genetically engineered for a reason, to be able to withstand a pesticide or herbicide that destroys and kills everything else in its path. And that's what is ending up on our dinner plate. And I would say it's not just that they're genetically engineered and then doused with these herbicides and pesticides, but then they go through the process of our system, which has been subsidized and therefore highly incentivized to be processed foods made with genetically engineered seeds that are highly filled with chemicals and additives and high in calories, sugar and salt, which is really unhealthy. So you're exactly right. We set up a system that is dangerous to our health, destructive to the environment. It's accelerating climate change. A lot of people don't know that industrial farming is the single biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the world, about 51%, according to World Watch. So we've created a system that is destroying our planet and our bodies, and we're actually incentivizing that and funding it and a taxpayer subsidized.
And, you know, to continue on the theme of what you don't know won't hurt you, they're insisting not only on no studies, but that we do not know what foods are genetically modified. They're obstructing labeling everywhere they can.
Well, you know, they've become highly proficient, not at creating healthy foods, but certainly about denying our rights as consumers. And they do it on every level of power, every level of political governance. You'll see Monsanto coming in to fight counties that are simply trying to keep genetically modified crops from contaminating local farmers' crops, which is what they also do too. So you're seeing, it's almost like a virus. We're seeing these crops spread throughout the world, and they contaminate other crops, and then those crops have to use the same kinds of Monsanto herbicides and pesticides. So we get into this cycle. So what they do is they'll spend whatever it takes and say whatever it takes to deny us even the right to know, which is a label, which, by the way, they provide to 64 other countries in the world. So the same big food, junk food corporations or Monsanto and DuPont that bankrolled the campaign against Prop 37 here in California and that bankroll any efforts to prevent labeling, they provide labeling in Europe and China and Russia. And so the idea that they can't do it or that it's too costly or it's a regulatory burden is insane. And really what they're saying is American consumers don't deserve the same rights as the rest of the world's consumers. And so then you'll see, but they also have refined other techniques. You know, they lobby Congress for farm bills that really subsidize the system that they control and essentially give out money to big agribusiness corporations. You're seeing it through the Monsanto Protection Act, which they were able to slip in as a rider in a larger bill that gives them essentially legal immunity, even if their foods are shown to be environmental and or health hazards. You're seeing them push for free trade agreements, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would allow them to override, perhaps, other countries' ability to label, states' rights to a label, to be able to label here. So you really do see a very sophisticated campaign of disinformation, fear tactics, legalized bribery of our politicians, and ads that, of course, bombard people with propaganda. And you put that all together, and they've got quite a racket going.
Zach, let me ask you a question. We hear from time to time about raids on organic milk suppliers. Even when people are agreeing, they're joining up, having membership to get organic milk. What's the argument against organic milk?
Well, you know, I didn't. Are you talking about raw milk or just organic?
Yeah, raw milk.
Yeah, you know, this is an issue that I'm fairly new to, and so you know, I wouldn't consider myself an expert on the raw milk issue, but I know that there's no evidence and no really peer-reviewed independent research that shows there is any health consequences to raw milk, and in fact, the opposite. That there's all kinds of benefits to drinking raw milk and not this pasteurized, hormone-filled, antibiotic, laced milk that we get in our stores. So I think what we're seeing with the attack on raw milk is their rightful fear that this would be a major threat because to the current industry and the current the kind of milk that we drink now, which of course is really a popular staple of the American diet. So I think that they realize that they've got to squash this, and regardless of the scientific evidence that shows just how healthy this raw milk is.
So they're trying to do a lot of stuff in secret. They don't want us to have these choices. They don't want us to know. Those of us who thought we were making some progress, the request for us to have less pesticide, more organic, it seems that these big agribusiness are trying to march in the opposite direction.
Well, they absolutely are. And, the good news is that even despite the fact that the system is so rigged against organic food and products just based on the way we subsidize conventional food and big ag, and then also the way that organic industry certainly doesn't have the advertising money to get their message out. It's very difficult sometimes to get into the mainstream stores, or at least it used to be. And it's also harder for small farmers to make a living these days. And then there's also just the attack that sometimes these small farmers and organic farmers get from companies like Monsanto and the spread of these genetically modified crops. And worse than that, it's getting harder and harder to find seed. This is another technique they use. By cornering the seed market, it's sometimes very difficult for farmers to even find seeds that are not genetically modified anymore. And you got to really work to do that. And, of course, once you get the genetically modified seed, you have to get Monsanto's herbicides and pesticides that go with it. So even considering all these factors and a terrible economy the last 5 years, organic industry has still grown three times the pace as the conventional food industry. Now, granted, it's only about 4.2%, I believe, of the total farm of our total food supply. But this is real progress, the fact that it's still growing at almost sometimes up to 10% a year. So people are still seeking out this kind of food, even if it's the label costs are higher and sometimes you've got to really look for these foods. The fact is people want this kind of, want organic more and more, and that's what we have going for us.
I see from the website that the Organic Consumer Association has a political program called the Organic Agenda 2005-2015, a six-point platform. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Are you talking about our overall kind of strategy, what we want to accomplish as an organization?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we pursue this kind of stuff on every level, these issues, so we tend to be, and I'll just talk more, you know, more broadly. I mean, we definitely tend to be an inside-outside organization. So, in other words, we'll participate in the Monsanto protests, March Against Monsanto, really deeply. We'll also get involved with counties' efforts to ban GMO crops, and we will sometimes use our, you know, power in terms of our financial power to be able to help these campaigns. Same thing with so labeling in Washington. There's a big initiative there this year that would do just like what Prop 37 tried to do in California, and it's looking very good. So we're really involved in that campaign. We've raised a lot of money for that campaign. So a lot of it is first transparency. So we've got to get labeling, and of course the end game is really getting off genetically engineered crops altogether, but there's a lot of steps that it's going to take to get there. We're also involved in the fracking issue, because fracking, of course, you know, if we pollute our air and water, we're polluting our farms and our soil, aside from driving climate change off the cliff. So we're involved in that issue as well. We're definitely going to be pushing against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because the last thing we need is free trade agreements that further undermine food safety and further increase the power of these giant food, junk food, biotech, and pesticide corporations. And so, you know, also the more we transition, and this is a piece of information a lot of people don't know, but the more we transition to organic and sustainable farming, what we've also found is that it makes the soil naturally sequester carbon. And if we transitioned completely to organic farming, we would be able to sequester 25% of our carbon emissions as a country. So there are all kinds of benefits to transitioning to organic, like, which is one of our main driving forces, you know, really what our organization is so intent on doing. And so it would have all these extra benefits. Aside from healthier food, it would really impact our global warming and our carbon emissions. So we're really multifaceted. And these really, it's about connecting these dots for people. Connecting
Thanks so much.
Climate change. Because,
I was just
going to
say...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, why don't you let people know how they can get in touch with your organization for their support?
Yeah. It's organicconsumers.org. And the best thing I can ask people to do is sign up for our weekly Bites newsletter. It's at the top right hand of the website. And it's a weekly newsletter where we give people actions every week, about five or six things people can do, really good articles. And I think that's how we're going to make change. If people are going to need to continue to rise up and speak out. And you know, that's what we're trying to facilitate.
Thanks so much. We sure appreciate it, Zach, and we'd love to have you back on again, okay?
Yeah, I would love that. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Listen, I also want to single out two people who've helped this show tremendously this week. Trish Shelton, who was a tremendous help getting us a source to Dr. Hansen. And also, of course, I want to thank my associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker, for the fine work that she puts in to help make this show what it is. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next week. This is News Director Rick Spezak for Progressive News Network. You have a good week, and we are building a better future.
Want to change the world? There's nothing to it, nothing to it. There is no life like the world of pure imagination. Living down, you'll be free, free if you truly wish to be. If you truly wish to be. If you truly